note that one other minister, the former interior minister, was forced to resign a year ago or half a year ago because her assistant had leaked confidential information about a refugee and was found guilty. And it wasn't until he was found guilty that she resigned. But instead of actually showing that they are, you know, have learned from it, they actually made her the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the parliament. So obviously these people that represent the parties that are in power have zero trust by the nation, or very little trust.
And we have only about a minute left, but could you tell us how Iceland has fared since the financial collapse? What's the state of your economy right now?
Okay, so we actually managed to do things right, and we were lucky enough to have a left-wing government that went through the austerity measures. In the wake of the crisis, we were the first Western country to go through an IMF program. We have had capital controls. We sort of closed Iceland off and we publicized, or we took ownership of the collapsed banks again. So we're doing actually quite well. We're in a really sensitive state of lifting the capital controls, and it is imperative that we have people that are lifting the capital controls that the general public in Iceland trust and the rest of the world.
Birgitta Jonsdottir, we have to leave it there, but we're going to do a post-show with you to find out the platform of the Pirate Party, and we'll post online at democracynow.org. Birgitta Jonsdottir is a member of the Icelandic Parliament with the Pirate Party. That does it for our show. Our 100-city tour starts tonight at Ithaca College on Monday. On Friday, we'll be in Columbus, Ohio, then St. Louis, Columbia, and Kansas City, Missouri on the 9th, Los Angeles and Santa Barbara on the 10th, San Francisco on the 11th, then to Stanford University and Santa Clara on the 12th. Check our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is now 8:01. Coming up next, we have Talk Radio, Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland. Your calls will be welcome at 503-231-8187. Our guest today is Tim DeChristopher. But first, these announcements.
KBOO Community Radio, along with Street Roots Newspaper, is proud to co-sponsor Amy Goodman's Portland appearance Sunday, May 8th, at the Aladdin Theater. She'll be talking about Democracy Now!, 20 years covering the movements changing America. Her new book, co-authored by David Goodman and Dennis Moynihan. And Amy will be doing a book signing after the talk. All proceeds go to benefit KBOO and Street Roots Newspaper. Again, that's Amy Goodman on Sunday, May 8th at the Aladdin Theater, 3017 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/democracynowbenefit. Democracy is coming to the
USA. KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Climate Change Tools for Faith Communities, a workshop led by Tim DeChristopher, Saturday, April 9th, starting at 10 a.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. During this day-long workshop, Sewell Lecture Speaker Tim DeChristopher will share integrated and multi-faith strategies to prevent climate change and environmental injustice, combat poverty, and restore dignity to both people and the planet. Again, that's a Climate Change Tools for Faith Communities, a workshop led by Tim DeChristopher, Saturday, April 9th at 10 a.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, accessories, and gifts with a focus on U.S. made and certified fair trade natural fiber clothing since 1984. Gazelle is located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at GazelleNaturalFiberClothing.com.
Have I been sleeping? I've been so still, afraid of crumbling. Have I been careless? Dismissing all the distant rumblings. Take me where I am supposed to be, to comprehend the things that I can't see. 'Cause I need to move. And as a child, I danced like it was 1999. My dreams were wild.
And good morning, and thank you, Melissa Etheridge, for the little tidbit from her song, I Need to Wake Up. Ain't That the Truth? And I do have on the phone my guest this morning, Tim DeChristopher, who's speeding on an Amtrak train towards us as we're going to be speaking. But Tim, if you can hold on just a second before I introduce you, I got a, as usual, a few announcements. We'll be talking about your talk coming up tomorrow evening as we go into the program. Just got a note of that a class, a Portland Underground Graduate School class related to this topic of this morning is going to be going for four Wednesdays from April 6th to the 27th. How to Thrive in These Times, Spiritual Resources for Climate Change and More, taught by Reverend Solveig Nilsen Gooden, Spiritual Director, Author, and Pastor of the Wilderness Way Community. That's going to be at Tabor Space, 5441 Southeast Belmont. And it looks like there's a cost for that. Space is limited to 20. Climate change is real, terrifying, and only one of the many profound crises humanity faces, given the enormity of the problem and its consequences. It can be hard to see options other than despair, denial, distraction, or depletion trying to fight back. So what do we do? Week one, facing facts. Week two, recovering. Week three, awakening leadership. Week four, creating and inspiring. PUGS Scholarship Fund makes courses accessible to people of all income levels. See our generosity policy. If you need a scholarship, email PUGScoordinator@gmail.com. All this is going to be on the website for this program, the page. You can go to www.pugspdx.com for information about this and other classes at the Portland Underground Graduate School, tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. at the Multnomah County Building, 501 Southeast Hawthorne. On October 7th, the city of Portland declared a housing state of emergency. Yet, at that council meeting, Commissioner Fish conceded, "Let's acknowledge that this vote in and of itself solves nothing." Indeed, it did not. Local news recently reported that Portland's rent increases are the highest in the nation, increasing at a rate of 14% over just 1 month. The snooze button emergency renter protections, 90 days notice on rent increases and no-cause evictions, did nothing to stop the exploitative price gouging. These protections did nothing to quiet the tsunami of forced displacement. So, on April 7th, 6 months to the day of Portland's declaration, we are asking you to join us in asking Multnomah County to take bold and decisive action. This is a note from their Facebook event page. This is a rally happening tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., if you can make it, 501 Southeast Hawthorne. It's time for rent control. It's time for protection from no-cause evictions. Another summer of evictions is around the corner. We can't wait. The time is now. This Saturday, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Chapman Square downtown, prisoners affiliated with the Industrial Workers of the World Union have announced plans to enact major work stoppages in Texas on Monday, April 4th, if their demands are not met. They will be meeting at Chapman Square at 6 p.m. We're organized with the Portland Anarchist Black Cross, IWOC, and Portland General Defense Committee. We'll share on recent organizing against prison slavery and the prison industrial complex happening nationally and in Oregon, followed by a march. Again, that's this Saturday, 6 to 8 p.m., Chapman Square. I'm going to leave some of these others for the end of the program and get right into our conversation with Tim. Thank you for your patience. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're quite welcome. So are you going through the gorge right now?
I am. Yeah, we just rolled out of White Salmon, Washington. And yeah, it's a beautiful morning to be rolling along the river.
And so where did you start your trip?
In Rhode Island.
Oh, wow.
I've been on the train for a while.
Yeah, I guess so. I hope you've gotten some sleep.
I have, yeah.
Nice, nice. So what are you doing in Rhode Island these days?
Well, I'm living there, and that's sort of the base of operations for my work, which is in a lot of different areas right now. Probably my most prominent work is with the Climate Disobedience Center, an organization that I helped launch just last fall to support other folks that are engaging with civil disobedience. I'm also doing a lot of work with religious communities around their efforts to work for climate justice, which is part of why I'm coming out here to Portland to work with the First Unitarian Church. And I'm also starting to get plugged in to Rhode Island organizing as well and working on some local efforts there.
Well, there's a number of different threads I'd like to pick up throughout this conversation. One of them is your decision to go to a divinity school and to become an ordained minister, I believe, and what that choice was all about, how that informs your current work. Obviously, that's the work you're doing now. What that grew out of, is that a long-standing thing? And I'd also like to, you know, there's a lot of continuities here going back to your work. People know you as Bitter 70. I'm sure you've been introduced hundreds, if not thousands, of times. You may be getting tired of that by now, but that was a major moment when you disrupted a Bureau of Land Management oil and gas auction back in 2008 by outbidding oil companies for parcels of land around Arches and Canyonlands National Parks in Utah, which netted you a 21-month imprisonment. So there were consequences to that action, as there often are to civil disobedience in this world. Anyway, that garnered you a lot of media attention and other attention from activists who applauded your courageous stand and, kind of gave you a renewed platform to continue and further your work. And kind of out of that, you helped organize a peaceful uprising in Salt Lake City. So you're basically, there's a lot of continuity to your work. So is that your decision to go to Harvard Divinity School, was that something that goes back a long way, or is that a more recent decision since you started becoming more active?
Well, that's a decision that came about once I became a serious activist. I'm going through some tunnels here, so you might lose.
Well, I was afraid of that.
Okay.
Oh, there you are.
Okay, I'm still here. I'm just going through some short tunnels. But that decision came about before I was incarcerated. During that time when I was a full-time activist, and I was seeing that the challenge for the climate movement was kind of shifting away from just being about reducing emissions, but to being about just as much figuring out how we maintain our humanity as we navigate this period of really intense change that's now largely inevitable. And so I was looking around the climate movement and realizing that we didn't really have the tools and the skills to even begin having that conversation about how we hold on to our humanity in desperate times, or how we maintain hope when we're fighting against impossible odds. But I felt like religious traditions did have a certain set of tools and skills for that. And so that's what I've been exploring. And after my first couple of years in divinity school, I decided that I didn't actually want to become an ordained minister, but that I did want to continue working with those communities and continue bringing that perspective into a lot of the work that I do.
Mm-hmm. I would like to remind people the number here to call in and join in this conversation with Tim DeChristopher is 503-231-8187. And so, you know, talk about some of the things you learned. I mean, that must be a very intense experience going to Harvard Divinity School.
It was challenging in a lot of ways. It was certainly useful. You know, I did discover that that a lot of folks have been exploring some of these same questions that that my activist community has been exploring and is still exploring. The people have been exploring them for decades or longer. People have been articulating their theories of intersectionality and the intersection of social justice issues for longer than I've been alive, in ways that the activist community I came out of was still grappling with and trying to articulate for themselves. And so that was certainly encouraging and empowering, and at the same time discouraging to see that there's been all this useful work done in the esoteric circles of academia in which they were just talking to each other and not really sharing those resources with the people that were actually engaging in these struggles. So it was both a useful and a frustrating experience for me.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, obviously there's quite a few examples. You know, people mention, obviously, Henry Thoreau as a precursor. People talk about Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., other figures like, you know, the Berrigan brothers. There's been many religious figures who've, obviously, Jesus Christ himself, many people see as a figure who is resistant to the overwhelming forces of his day. And, you know, perhaps all major religious figures have had that sort of countercurrent tendency. Is there something inherently in a sort of a spiritual orientation that sets itself at odds with, you know, the worldly forces?
I think that you know, a lot of the major religious traditions in our country today that are not at odds with the status quo, but are just reinforcing the status quo. You know, I don't think it's inherent in a religious perspective that you work for justice. You know, I think that has to be a choice. I think that having that foundation of a spiritual perspective can make you more resilient and effective at working for justice, but it's not automatic. It's still a choice that has to be made, and I think still a rare one, frankly, in most of our religious communities.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you're speaking at the Unitarian Church. Do you consider yourself any particular faith? Do you belong to a particular community?
The Unitarian Church has been my religious community since about 2007.
Uh-huh.
And certainly a big part of what helped see me through my own process of you know, being vaulted into a spotlight and then being incarcerated and you know, going through that whole process. The Unitarian Church was really my rock and my support throughout that time, and so that's definitely where I have the strongest connection and the thing that feels closest to a spiritual home for me.
Well, you know, I mean, anybody who is an activist obviously has, I guess, that not universally, but certainly in my experience, I've seen, you know, a lot of events happen at Unitarian churches all over the place. It's one of the denomination that opens up its space for concerts, for workshops, for talks, perhaps that seems to be no accident. But we don't necessarily talk that much about, you know, the history of Unitarianism, some of the history of some of these denominations in relation to confronting injustice, confronting the issues. Oh, well, I knew this was going to be problematic, but are you still there? So we're going to have to bring Tim back. But we do have a phone caller. If Johnny wants to talk to me, we're going to try to get Tim back on the air. I was afraid that we're going to have some difficulties in talking to Tim while he's on the Amtrak, but I didn't think of the tunnel problem coming through the gorge. Anyway, Johnny, are you on the air?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hello. So what did you have to say?
Oh, well, first of all, I'm hoping that Tim is listening. I really wanted to express my gratitude to him for for taking that initiative. I see my as a light worker or an activist myself. I also see that there is a lot of work to be done in the area of combating, I guess the best way to put it is misery or suffering during these trying times that we are facing. And I also wanted to just kind of put out there that I have been doing a lot of deep research, like inner research and inner questions. And, you know, I have my angels that I talk to. And, of course, I like to believe that I have a very strong connection and communication with Christ. And so a lot of answers come in form of epiphany. And what has been brought to my attention is that we, and I speak of all humanity as people, are very strong, and we have the ability to create very powerful things. And of course, look what we have created and what we're living in now. And with this being said, we have the power to make the choice in our minds of what we think and how we think about it. And the choice lies between having pain or hatred towards the powers that be that were driving the machine of climate change, and understanding that these are also people too. And they were created with love by Creator, whatever your denomination is, whoever your God is. And so it is up to us to find that in our own hearts. And if we understand that, like it, as individuals, the more people that can find that in their hearts and say, okay, well, you know, they're a person too, they know, they really know not what they do, even though they know they're just there. There's greed, or there's or whatever drives the situation. It can be turned over by a simple act of activism within the self, and that self is a very powerful. The heart mechanism is a very powerful mechanism for turning the consciousness. And so basically what I'm saying is if like an individual can find love in all things, that will not, it will send out that message and not the message of hate, which creates, it flips the coin in a matter of speaking.
Okay. So well, I think we have Tim back on. Maybe Tim wants to respond to what you've been saying.
Sure. Yeah. I missed the very beginning of that, but, you know, I think this is a lot of what I've been grappling with in my own studies and in my own experience. Something that I that actually my time in prison helped me to kind of come to terms with of the impact of that hatred for our enemies and why that's so destructive. Even if it seems justified, it's certainly not helpful. That balance of the suffering and of the joy of the world is a big part of what I'm going to be focusing on tomorrow night, and how we seem to be in this really interesting position in history, I feel like, right now, with what I consider to be divergent realities that seem to be accelerating in opposite directions, where we can look at the incredible progress of the climate movement just over the past year, with the Keystone victory and a lot of other victories like Jordan Cove out here in Oregon, and stuff that we never really thought was possible before, and victories in the Keep It in the Ground campaign, and then look at sort of the facts on the ground of climate change that continues to accelerate much faster than the worst case scenario projections, and we keep getting more and more bad news on that, and we can look at sort of the positive side of the movement that keeps growing and bringing new people in, and new people keep bringing all this enthusiasm into the climate movement, and yeah, we keep burning people out at the same time, and exhausting people and kind of crushing people's spirits within our own activist community, and just sort of how we make sense out of those divergent realities of how we keep struggling for our values when it doesn't seem to make sense all the time. And that's stuff that I can't claim to have figured out. Part of the role that I see for myself in the movement is just sort of expanding the boundaries of the discussion a little bit, and encouraging people to ask those questions, and particularly with my work with young folks, the thing that I tell them over and over and over is that nobody has this stuff figured out, that we are in completely unprecedented territory, and that none of us really have the answers here, and that we need them to jump in and try to figure out answers, and be empowered to do that, just with, like everybody else.
John, are you still there?
Yeah.
Do you have any final thoughts?
Yeah. And so yeah, I totally agree with that, and I would like to add that there are things that there's information that we can involve in our activism, and it has to do a lot with the technology that we have, and I'm not sure if we have enough time. I'd like to make room for other callers, but there is an institute called the Heart Institute that has discovered that humans create an electromagnetic connection between their hearts. This is an actually mapped out and photographed actual connection that happens when you share compassion with another person. And it's basically, it's the reason why people who are in love with each other can finish each other's sentence, because there's a psychic bond there. And this happens with everybody, with all humans. And so there are these types of very deep connections that allow us as humans to break down those barriers of indecision or of grief, and to allow the understanding of hey, somebody is there, somebody does care, without actually having to say it over and over again. And also, I would like to bring to light, this is something that I heard, I think I saw it on a documentary, the same topic, but in a different genre, that I've seen that in other countries. I believe in Italy, they're having trouble growing grapes, and so, but because it's getting hotter there, And so they're starting to grow olives instead. And so I think this is one facet of the climate change that we can grasp onto and say, okay, you know, like, since, you know, things are changing, let's try not to hold on to what's going to disappear. Let's look at what, you know, what we can bring into the future and what we can facilitate
okay.
in that manner.
Well, we do have some other callers, but thank you so much for calling, Johnny.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah. And that's opens up a whole discussion. Many discussions, as always, but the whole issue of adaptation to is a kind of a tricky area. Maybe we want to explore that a little bit. You know, I understand the idea of like sort of not holding on to, but there's also a danger there, I think, in that we are heading into frighteningly uncharted territory, and it's too easy to sort of use that as a way of sort of giving up on actually resisting the continued drivers of what's making climate change, because I think people are increasingly realizing the possibility that if that happens, we could be actually signing our collective death sentence. So I don't know if you want to respond to anything that Elsa Johnny said and my response, Tim.
I do think it's essential to start having the conversation about adaptation. There are really three responses to climate change that will happen in some combination, and that's mitigation, adaptation, and suffering. And we've passed the point where we're going to do enough mitigation to avoid the need for adaptation and the need for suffering. There will be things that we simply can't adapt to at this point because we're so late in the game, and because there is so much massive impacts that we are going to face. I think the idea that if we talk about it being too late to really stop climate change, that people are going to give up and that people are going to use that as an excuse not to fight. I've never seen that to be the case. The people that I see that are fighting the strongest are those that have internalized the reality that that it's too late to avoid catastrophic impacts. I don't see that making sense in human nature, that people give up when things get that bad. I think it actually increases our bond with the things that we're fighting for when we internalize how serious the threats really are. I think just from a global perspective, the lack of a conversation about adaptation is creating some really serious social justice impacts right now. I think we saw that in Paris, where before the Paris negotiations, the last thing to be cut out of the negotiations was any kind of fund for the relocation of communities. The people signing the agreement in Paris agreed to aim for 1.5 degrees C, which it's already too late to prevent that. We're already past that. Even if we shut everything down at this point, we wouldn't avoid that kind of impact. But by putting that in.
Oh, looks like Tim's going through a tunnel. This is a little bit awkward, but please bear with us. And while we're waiting for him to come back, I'm speaking with Tim DeChristopher, and he's coming to town. He's on a train going through the gorge right now, which is why he's fades in and out. Anyway, he's in town tomorrow evening for a lecture at the First Unitarian Church Sanctuary at 7 p.m. That's at 1211 Southwest Main Street. His topic is Wielding the Power of Vulnerability, and we're trying to get him back on the line right now. Anyway, that's what we're talking about this morning. Excuse me. He's also going to be giving a workshop, which we've been announcing here on KBOO, Saturday, April 9th, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., Climate Change Tools for Faith Communities, sponsored by a wide variety of groups. Let me just take this opportunity to mention one more thing. Saturday, April 23rd, coming up at Oregon State University at the LaSalle Stewart Center is the Thin Green Line, Creative Resistance to Fossil Fuel Development in the Pacific Northwest. Join us for an afternoon and evening of speakers, workshops, and a community fair honoring the people who are imagining a new energy future and fighting to keep fossil fuels in the ground, with Eric DePlace of the Sightline Institute, Ryan Pierce, artist and activist, Taylor Broerby, editor, and Kathleen Dean Moore, author of Fracture, Essays, Poems, and Stories on Fracking, and Patrick Mazza, former KBOO. Well, I think he may have been KBOO, but anyway, I used to work with him on the Alliance newspaper, a longtime climate activist and journalist, and one of the Delta 5 arrestees. And that's going to be Saturday, April 23rd at Oregon State University. You can visit the Spring Creek Project online for more information at liberalarts.oregonstate.edu/etc. I will again have that on the promo page for this program, or the archive page, Wednesday Talk Radio. Tim, you're back with us.
Yes. Sorry about that. I went through another tunnel.
we'll take that as a metaphor. So,
So the point that I was making there is that, you know, by putting out there these false expectations that we are going to limit climate change to a level that avoids any of this hardship, that avoids certain countries going underwater and that sort of thing, it allows the rich nations to avoid taking any responsibility and having that conversation about restitution and about relocation funds and all those things. So I think we need to start having that conversation about adaptation and about what those of us in rich nations owe the parts of the world that are facing real suffering because of our actions.
Well, I guess it comes down to the same discussion for me, because the same, you know, demanding, asking for, wishing, desiring that the people who have who are the beneficiaries of the accumulation and centralization of power and control, let's just put it that way, and whether they're nation states, corporations, the actors that, you know, have developed and maintained and continued this machine or system or whatever you want to call it, that, you know, is responsible for the burning of vast amounts of fossil fuel and other actions that are destabilizing our climate. You know, trying to stop the actions that are resulting in climate change and trying to get those corporations, nation states, whatever, to devote some of the funds that has been accumulated through this process. It comes down to the same thing, doesn't it? Because they're, you know, that's exactly what they don't want to do. They don't want to change the discourse. They don't want to change direction. They don't want to sacrifice their privileges. So, of course, they're going to resist deploying, you know, resources to help the victims. It's, you know, part of it, it's admitting that the problem is so great that we have to do that sort of thing. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, what it comes down to is power. And it's about shifting power away from that concentration of wealth so that they no longer have the ability to do that. And, you know, we're starting to see some hints of that, like the accountability and investigations in ExxonMobil, for their decades of lying about climate change and committing fraud, lying to the government, all those sort of things. You know, we're starting to see a whole coalition of state attorney generals around the country actually standing up to them for the first time. And I think that represents a real shift in power. We're seeing that
you know, with the coal industry and all the bankruptcies that are happening there. But we still see that that small minority of individuals at the very top of those companies are able to hold on to their own profits and just shortchange their workers in the local communities, even as their companies are collapsing. You know, we saw Arch Coal file for bankruptcy this winter, and the day before Arch Coal filed for bankruptcy, their executives gave themselves $8 million in bonuses so that, you know, they could make sure that when those assets are distributed during the Chapter 11 process, it doesn't go to their workers' pensions, it doesn't go to the communities that need environmental remediation, it continues to go into their bank accounts. So we certainly still have a lot of work to do in actually shifting that power structure and overthrowing that corporate control of our society.
And again, I'm speaking with Tim DeChristopher, who is racing towards Portland on an Amtrak train as we speak, and we've lost him a couple times, but we've been able to get him back each time after he goes through the tunnel. And he's going to be in town again for a couple of events on tomorrow at the First Unitarian Church. He's going to be talking about wielding the power of vulnerability, the 2016 Sewell Lecture, and Saturday, this coming Saturday, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., a workshop, Climate Change Tools for Faith Communities. The number to call to get in on this conversation, you only have 20 minutes left, 503-231-8187. Before we get into the nitty-gritty, a little bit of the talk you're giving, wielding the power of vulnerability and what that means, you've kind of touched on it. Just to follow up on what you're just saying, you know, a discussion that, again, it's, you know, given that we don't have the power to enforce this, it often seems, you know, has an air of futility about it. But sometimes the just talking about things opens up new space, you know, like we started talking about tearing down the dams, you know, 20, 30 years ago in the Pacific Northwest. And not that that by itself led to dams coming down, but, you know, you have to first imagine possibility before, and our imagination is so restricted these days that anything that breaks the lock hold of the restricted imagination is a good thing. So I think talking about seizing corporate assets is something that I've been thinking a lot about. Back in when the BP mega disaster happened a number of years ago, there was a few people who talked about, well, let's just seize their assets. They're not doing, you know, entrusting BP to like guide and deal with the disaster they created was a losing proposition, just like, you know, TEPCO managing the continuing mind-boggling mega disaster, you know, that's going on in Japan and now all over the world with the release of radiation, just like the Southern California gas company's methane geyser that was gushing for months, just like Exxon Valdez, it's a, you know, you name it. What, seize their assets. Don't let these people give themselves, you know, and again, that kind of language, don't let them. Well, who's going to not let them? It goes back to the power question. But that point is, like, at least let's start talking about, you know, and not just talk about sort of vague generalities about capitalism, but like specific mechanisms that maybe we need to start thinking about.
Yeah, you know, and I would add to that list that you just gave, the disaster in the Animas River in Colorado, you know, which was an old coal mine site that had been left to the public to clean up, where the company just absconded and didn't clean up their own mess. So it was left to the EPA to try to clean up. And they ended up with...
You're breaking up. Maybe we'll just wait a few seconds here. Go ahead, try now. Nope. We'll just hope that he comes back in a couple of minutes. But we do have another caller. Craig, go ahead. You're on the air. Hello?
I just wanted to commend Tim for coming on Amtrak because he could come here He could have come here 2.5 days sooner if he'd come on an airplane flight. So anyway, just wanted him to comment on transportation choices people should make if they're concerned about this issue.
Uh-huh.
And I want to state my admiration. As soon as I heard about what he did, I was so impressed by his courage, and I just admire him very much.
You mean the bidding on those oil and gas leases?
That's right.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm not too much on talking over the years, so I'll take my... But I just admire the guy, and I think more activists of his fame, you might say, need to make choices like he is for their own inconvenience, because if they're flying all over the world, how serious are they really about saving the Earth? That's my point.
Okay. Well, I'll have to repeat that question as we're just getting him back on the line. And so... Again, I am talking off and on. I apologize for the somewhat unwieldy, but Tim DeChristopher, you can hear him uninterrupted tomorrow evening at the First Unitarian Church. And I've got looks like Tim is back on the air. And Tim, you were just complimented for taking the Amtrak and not flying as you could have done and gotten here earlier. I assume that's a conscious choice that you make to not fly.
It is. And you know, there are a lot of reasons for that. You know, I don't necessarily do it dogmatically. It's a much more pleasant option. You know, it's not only a low carbon form of travel, which, you know, I think is exactly the kind of shift that we need to be making in our society. This is a way of travel where you actually get to meet people, you get to see your country, you get to experience the fact that you're traveling. It's actually much more humane way of traveling, I think.
Your connection is breaking up again. This is becoming a little bit difficult here. But Tim was just saying that rail travel is not just better for carbon footprint, but it's also more pleasant. You can actually see the country, get to visit people with people, talk to people, meet people, and not be trapped in this box flying, you know, thousands of feet above the earth. Are you still there, Tim? Oh, we lost him again. Well, 503-231-8187 is the number to call in and talk about flying versus railroad. You know, that's something I wanted to talk about a lot, the whole issue of railroads, you know, because this whole high-speed train thing is sort of, I think, become a bit of a fetish on among progressives, the idea that that will sort of solve everything. My feeling is that we need to actually make the tracks all public. We need to take them away from the freight companies. We need to bring back the abandoned lines, all the secondary lines that used to even unite small and medium-sized towns in Oregon, not just the I-5 corridor, Amtrak corridor, mainly I-5. Goes over to Klamath Falls. But that's what we have to focus on, and to create strong regional railroad networks like they have in the Northeast and could happen everywhere. We could have trains that don't have to wait for the freight trains oftentimes, like the Amtrak. And sometimes if you ride the Amtrak, you have to get on a bus to catch up to the train later on because it's accumulated so many hours of delay. And of course, that's one of those things that the Republican, mostly Republican, but not only, politicians hold in hostage, you know, because Amtrak is socialism, as if the massive defense spending isn't some form of socialism. Anyway, I think we need to, if there's going to be any kind of way to maintain some semblance of some sort of larger social structure, which I think needs to basically be dismantled, we need to bring back a better rail network. But we have Marianne on the line. Go ahead, Marianne. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for speaking about taking the railroads back, the tracks back. You're the only person I've ever heard say that. This is one of my, you know, pet peeves. Every other form of transportation is publicly owned. The airports, the roads. Why are the train tracks private? And most companies, most civilized, industrialized countries, long ago took over their railroad tracks. So,
yeah, it's a scandal. It goes back to the unification of the United States and the power of the railroads, and of course, some of the worst, you know, the worst precedents that led to Citizens United, you know, the concentration of political power by corporations, were decisions made on behalf of railroad companies. The power of the railroads in the formation of the United States cannot be underestimated.
Yeah, but the problem is that was done privately because of capitalism. There was so much money to be made, you know, they had to do it privately. But also, it's the bad thing about it is the lingering effect of that anti-railroad sentiment that grew up, rightfully, you know, grew up in this country, is now unhelpful. You know, because it's sort of, even though none of us alive now lived through those times when the railroads were in, and they were like the oil companies are now, you know. Everybody hated them, but they kept giving them their money anyway. But the lingering anti-railroad sentiment is now dysfunctional for us. You know, we really need to support rail travel, but more publicly owned. And there are some tracks that are owned by Amtrak now. A lot of the new track that's being built is publicly owned. But
oh, really? Which one is that?
There's some in California and some on the East Coast, I believe. Yeah. There's not a lot, but the railroads themselves are tearing up track because they have to pay property taxes on it, right? And we're actually moving more freight by rail now than ever in the history of this country on less track. And there's too much congestion on the rails, which slows down Amtrak trains.
And, of course, that's particularly dangerous now that we've got these oil bomb trains going on those tracks. That's another reason to completely transform our transportation. Well, Tim, you caught the tail end of that, but Marianne was... I had in your absence, was talking about the need to, you know, to take over to nationalize, or I think regionalize, really, the railroads in this country, to, you know, if there's going to be any persistence of any kind of large scale, wide geographic ability of people to maintain travel and communication connections in the face of climate chaos, I think some form of rail is a good bet. And so we need to start melting down all the cars and making new rails and bring back and nationalize or regionalize the railroad tracks. Anyway, Marianne called up to thank me for being the first person she's ever heard mention the idea of taking back the railroad tracks. What are your thoughts on that as you ride on Amtrak?
By the way, I want to say one thing. I don't know if people realize this, but twice in the history of this country, the government did take over the railroads during World War One and World War Two.
Aha. Well, that's interesting because people, you know, hearken to the idea of the need for a World War Two type of mobilization to confront the climate crisis. So there you go.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks for promoting railroads.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Tim.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly support increased development in railroads of all kinds. I think the public-private nature of our current railroad system is almost one of public investment and private rewards and private profits. That was actually one of the issues involved with the Delta 5 climate necessity defense case up in Seattle a couple of months ago, which involved a protest on the BNSF tracks.
Oh, no. Well, this is just not working out today. Tim, for all our best efforts, Are you still there, Tim? Well, we lost him again. We have 5 minutes left, and I apologize profusely for the disjointed nature of this, but I think we've gotten some good good points in, some good conversation, some good callers. And you can hear Tim, as I said, uninterrupted tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland at 1211 Southwest Main. Tim will be speaking about facing fear and confronting climate change and wielding the power of vulnerability, something that I wanted to get into a little more specifically. And, well, I guess we're just going to have to let Tim go because, but we have some more announcements coming up. Natural Burial, Family-Directed Funerals and Rituals of Remembrance, 3 workshops, a film, conversation, site tours, and lunch. A day of learning and conversation to honor Earth Day in Portland on April 9th and in the Columbia Gorge on April 29 to 30. You can attend all or part of the day-long program in either location. Natural Burial, Why, How, Where, led by David Noble, Executive Director of Riverview Cemetery. Home Funerals, DIY Memorials and Other Rituals of Remembrance, led by Holly Pruitt, Life Cycle Celebrant and Home Funeral Guide. Creating a Death Plan and Planning for a Natural Burial, led by Jody Bullier, Cemetery Manager for White Eagle Memorial Preserve. Tours of the region's top urban and rural natural burial grounds. The award-winning documentary, A Will for the Woods. Registration, space is limited. Advanced registration is strongly advised. Reserve your spot today. Where to go to do that? Well, I don't have that information, unfortunately, but you can call me at the front desk after the show, 503-231-8032, and I will be sure to put all that information on the program page for this show, Wednesday Talk Radio, of this date. Again, Saturday, April 23rd, 1 to 9 p.m., the Thin Green Line, Creative Resistance to Fossil Fuel Development in the Pacific Northwest, LaSalle's Stewart Center at Oregon State University. You can go to their site for more information about that. That's at Spring Creek Project online. And there's a series of civil disobedience workshops coming up to stop the to oppose expansion of coal, oil, and gas projects in the Pacific Northwest. There'll be one on Saturday, April 16th, downtown, Tuesday, April 26th in Southeast Portland. You can call or text 503-705-1943 or go to 350pdx@gmail.com. You can email there. Free training includes overview of Northwest fossil fuel projects, individual grounding, possible legal consequences, know your rights, action roles and tactics, action planning and practice. If you've never done a civil disobedience workshop training, this is a wonderful opportunity. You can you learn a lot. You really come into, you know, more contact with the reality of the legal system and the nature of power, and maybe break down some of your own fears and resistances towards engaging in civil disobedience. Next Thursday, Who Are My People? A powerful documentary film in the Mojave Desert of California, where Native elders fight energy development on sacred lands. That's Thursday, April 14, 7 to 10 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, sponsored by KBOO. And, well, we're almost out of time, so let's just wrap it up for now. Again, you can go to our website, kboo.fm, and find out more about all this. One last thing. Rosehip Medics Collective presents a new people's disaster training April 16th and 17th. That's very important. Go to rosehipsmedics@gmail.com. Write them there to find out about the People's Disaster Training coming up by Rosehips Medics Collective. Thank you so much for listening, and stay tuned for more great programming here on KBOO Community Radio. My name is Paul. It's been Wednesday Talk Radio.
And as a child, I danced like it was 1999. My dreams were wild. The promise of this new world would be mine. Now I am throwing off the carelessness of youth to listen to.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Tim DeChristopher Lecture, Wielding the Power of Vulnerability, Thursday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Tim DeChristopher, as bidder 70, disrupted a Bureau of Land Management oil and gas auction in 2008 by outbidding oil companies for land parcels around Arches and Canyonlands National Parks in Utah. His actions led to a 21-month imprisonment. Again, that's a lecture by Tim DeChristopher titled Wielding the Power of Vulnerability, Thursday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and it is now just 9 o'clock on April 6th, this Wednesday. Coming up this morning on The Boo at 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints, reports on Mexican environmentalist